Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to tonight's seminar in the series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. I'm Paul Clow. It gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Mr. Robert Mitzi. Robert is from Canada. He has his BA degree in drama and education from the University of Windsor, Ontario, and his master's of education degree from the University of Alberta in the field of international education. Robert has spent the last 2 years, a rather exciting 2 years, working in Kosovo with a project of the Canadian Development Agency, CEDA. The project is called Kosovo Education Development Project. And in this project, he is one of the two Canadians. He is a professional development consultant developing education and teacher training practices and procedures for a complete revamping of the Kosovo education system within the university in Kosovo. And tonight, Robert is going to speak to the whole question, what does Queer Peace International do? What is it all about? This question arose out of his master's research, and it leads to the topic for tonight's seminar. And the title of tonight's seminar is Unraveling Queerness in Social Research. So over to you, Robert.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. Last time I was here, it was about 10 years ago, and I walked out of the airport and I saw this big sign that said Mitzi Corporation. And I thought, wow, the family's done really well. Amazing. And then now, 10 years later, I come back and I'm like, wow, the whole country's changed. So, from what I've seen, and it's amazing just seeing how all the development that has gone on. So it's good to be back. Yes, so I am in Kosovo, and I'm in kind of in two streams of reasons why I'm in Kosovo. One of them was what Paul had mentioned before with the Kosovo Educator Development Project. But I'm also there as a volunteer and to help build the Gay and Lesbian Association of Kosovo and such. And that's something that's been exciting for me to take part in. I've done work with queer communities in Kosovo, not only in Kosovo, but in the UK, in Canada, and Japan. So I have a bit of a background as to how culture and society can affect queerness and queer being. So it's good to be able to share that with you, especially to my ancestral homeland. So it's nice. I'm going to move slides along so to kind of explore a bit about what I'm going to be talking about tonight. Some objectives to tonight. First off, to explore a deeper meaning of queer as it relates to identity formation. And with that, I mean just how is it being queer? And I'd like to actually try to capture that in a Maltese context of some kind. So I invite you all to speak forward as to how being queer, and I'm going to explain what queer means. So you may be queer, you don't even know you're queer, and so you may just to express that your experiences. I ask you to share some knowledge. I ask you to speak from what you feel and what you know. And then we're going to also again describe some more experiences and such. I'm going to try to pull from some of my again my work and my research as well on peace education with queer people, and also to put forth some suggestions for future directions based on international experiences and more importantly local experiences as well. You know, where do we want to go? What paths does Malta want to set? And again, I emphasize to integrate participant experiences into some form of collective reasoning, understanding, integration of queerness in Malta and such. And again, if you feel, I'm always one to connect marginalizations and experiences and such. So if you feel that you have experienced some sort of discrimination or prejudice, or even some successes of some sort, connect those. Let's see how it relates to being queer and such. Now, what is this word queer all about? You know, it's a new word for a lot of people, and I thought I would take a moment to explore it a bit further with you. Queer, from www.hyperdictionary.com, as you can see, it describes some of the different types of definitions. Offensive for an openly homosexual man, beyond or deviating from the usual or expected, homosexual or arousing homosexual desires, not as expected, put as dangerous or disadvantageous. My favorite part when I was looking at this is the part that says see also. And I highlight a few of them. Fag, faggot, gay, homophile, homosexual, poof, queen, strange, suspect, unusual. Now think about what that does to you if you're called that. You're already set aside from being different. You're different. You're not normal. You're unusual. And so what we're trying to do is to reclaim this, because this is a term that was used in English language in the 60s, 70s as a very derogatory. People were called queer on the streets, queer as they're being beaten up, queer in a sense of degradation, humiliation. And now we're reclaiming this in the sense of queer theory, queer studies and such, to prove that we are unique. We're normal, we're fun-loving, fabulous people, and we'd like to meet all of you. So that's what it's like. And so I've kind of changed this definition to becoming and belonging as a lesbian, gay male, bisexual male, female, transsexual, intersexed, transgendered person, straight or heterosexual ally. And that always, that last bit is always kind of catching. Some people say, "Oh, it means I'm queer and I'm straight," but it does. If you really believe in queer causes and such, you're invited to identify as being queer and such. And so I invite and welcome the straight and heterosexual ally, because it is important. At the prides that take place in Canada, it's always the straight people marching that get a lot of applause, because they're usually parents, they're sisters, brothers, and those are powerful people. So that's why I speak from my personal experience, that is something that's very important. We extended also that section, gay and lesbian, GLBT, which is gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, two-spirit, and homosexuality. Now, the word two-spirit is something that's new, and it comes from North America, Aboriginal communities. In the Aboriginal times, before Canada was colonialized, or the States was colonialized, to have gay, lesbian, trans, or bisexual tendencies, you're seen as having the spirit of a man and a woman inside of you. And so that was, then you were held in a special position in the tribe. You were held as like as an advisor or a consultant to the elder and to the chief. So they were identified as being called two-spirit. And now when colonialism came in, homophobia became a social disease. And so it no longer was acceptable to be two-spirited. So now there is a greater movement within the Aboriginal culture. And I'm very sensitive to neocolonialism. I'm very sensitive to being calling an Aboriginal person queer, because that is a term that the West, Europe, North America is using. I don't want to call them queer, because unless they would like to be called queer. So they would like to be called two-spirit. So I call them in solidarity, two-spirited. I think it's a beautiful word too. Out of that, you get some really fun things happen from when you have queer culture. And you can see us in the cartoon. It says, "Your father and I want to thank you for teaching us a secret gay and lesbian handshake." You know, and now we begin to learn different types of expressions and such from being queer. Now, queer theory touched a bit on my work, but I can explain that a bit further. Foucault is basically the father of queer theory, and I'm just going to touch a bit about queer theory. It's quite a study. It's in depth. You can spend a semester going through it. But I just thought let's talk a little bit about it just to start off the discussions and such. Foucault says, "Queer theory is not a singular or a systemic conceptual or methodological framework, but a collection of intellectual engagements with the relations between sex, gender." Okay. It's not a formula in a sense of how to approach queer people. It's more a collection of ideas, thoughts, actions that challenge heterosexuality, in a sense. It's not step by step, this is the theory, this is what happened and such. It introduces thoughts and ideas that challenge heterosexuality as a normative, as a social sexual norm. And it promotes non-straightness as another way of living, you see. And that's where it really stems from. If you look at what we have in our culture, we have, whenever you want to promote, to set forth some action, you want to have an association, you want to have a community, you want to have a culture and such. Queer theory debunks that. It doesn't really agree with that's the way to do it. Because to have this idea of communities, associations or such, that stems from capitalism and heterosexualized capitalism. And what queer theory asserts is that if you had just some fluidity of ideas and thoughts integrating into the mainstream society and such, that debunk heterosexuality, that presents a queer option, that produces the change that you would like to have. However, as someone who works in the field, having these types of associations and community groups are familiar, and this is what works in some regard. So there is some contradiction within queer theory in that sense, because it's good in an academic sense to challenge heterosexuality and see how it is setting aside and putting queers as a differentiated group of people, not as a normative. But when you have queers who are trying to live their lives and such, and to in all spectrums, that's where queer theory comes in, because it debunks film theory, it debunks media, it debunks power relations between genders. It really breaks down a lot more. And then, so I'm just going to put that right. It really works on power relations, and that's between the social and the political. And that's where a lot of it heads toward. So I hope that's kind of making it clear to you. Again, queer theory is massive, but I'm trying to make it as simple as I can. Transgender identification is something is part of queer theory, breaking down sex and gender differences and how someone identifies within their gender. I just remember the story where I had a volunteer consultant. He came to me one day and he said, "I think I'm going to become a woman." And I was... I'm a bit unsure about transgendered work, and at that time, so I thought, okay, let's, you know, I support you on that, let's, and go ahead. This happened in Canada. And so he began to refer to himself as Allison. He began dressing as Allison. And I made mistakes. I called him by his masculine name. I had apologized, and I said, sorry, I'm transitioning with you. I'm really trying to learn. And it's been, and to me, that's what works. That's addressing things from an honest point of view, positioning yourself and where you are when it comes to queer issues. And that's where it all starts from. Yes, mother, I am living the gay lifestyle. So I think it's only fair that I tell you that I'm gay. The alternative lifestyle is something that came out from the 80s or 90s. It was seen as another type of otherism. We accept you, but you're just over there. You're not really a part of us, you see. And that's where the lifestyle part came in. And in English language, now that's being seen as offensive to call someone, oh, how's your lifestyle? I don't live a lifestyle. I live a life. And so that's where we're trying to, again, work with language a bit more to clean it up. My best friend, actually, one day she's a teacher, an elementary school teacher, and she said to a student, don't do that. That's so gay. She didn't realize, you know. And then she told me the story, and I thought, ooh, let's talk about why you think that phrase, "that's so gay," is not so good. Because I don't think it is. I don't say to you, God, that's such a woman, you know. Oh, you throw like a black man, you see?
You say nigger.
Pardon me?
You say nigger.
Oh, you say nigger. Oh. Yeah.
No,
it's not acceptable in my culture. But,
Because we also use pejorative names, like for example, she. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's ageism right there, and such, and it probably links to feminism as well. So, so that's where we are trying to fix up our language a bit more, in such. And this is one example, and queer theory helps support that because language comes from film, it comes from our media, and this is what we need to continue working with. Now, my area is in peace education. I can tell you a bit about where this came from. In just the first year of my master's, I got really interested in peace education. I was doing peace education before I even knew what it was. I was very captured. The whole idea of asserting an educational paradigm that builds peace, reconciliation, social healing, something that really speaks to me. And so I sat with a professor of mine, Dr. To Sweehin, and I said, peace education, what kind of project could I work on? What kind of thesis? And he says, peace education doesn't speak to two community groups. One is the gay and lesbian population. The second is the disabled population. I don't know as much about disabled or ableism, but I knew a lot about gay and lesbian studies. So I thought, well, let's try it out. And I proceeded, and I became the first person to look at queer perspectives on peace education. And from there, I established an international network of queer peace educators, and now we're called Queer Peace International. It's a network at its stages, where it's why it's kind of fitting for the theme of the seminar series. It's a works in progress. But to date, our membership is growing. And the type of activities that are involved in, for example, would be a holistic healing center for gay and lesbian people, and there's one in New Hampshire that's connected to the network. There's also conflict resolution for gay and lesbian people in Italy. I heard recently there's lesbian activists in Israel protesting against the treatment of the Palestinians. So, there's interesting things coming out that we try to engage. The area isn't as such highlighting human rights violations and such, because I think Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch does wonderful jobs of that. I don't want to replace what work they do. However, we're kind of focusing more on the social healing side of things. How do you deal with the pain that you're suffering, and how do you react to that? Do you react back with violence, or are you prepared to react with nonviolence, or reach to some level of forgiveness and such? So that's the area that we're more concentrated on, building support networks and such. There's a really excellent NGO that comes out of the Netherlands that funds new gay and lesbian associations in Eastern Europe. That's what one of the major things is, money that's needed for these type of initiatives. And so, COC, I don't know what it is it's in Dutch, what it stands for. I don't know what that is. And so I can, if anybody wants, they can get my website. I can get you the website information for that. Now let's learn a bit about what peace education is. Reardon, 1988, argues that education should be centered on the development to learn, deepening knowledge and resourcefulness, and developing a positive human potential. Peace education should be capable of providing in this focus, fragmenting knowledge into isolated skill sets, subsets, only results in a holistic disconnectedness between each subject area. Now, if you kind of think back a bit, that makes some truth, because when I was working I was managing a gay men's project in Western Canada, and I found myself speaking to many people. I taught at the Faculty of Medicine, but then the next week I would be over speaking to deaf interpreters. I'd be speaking next to student teachers. I'd be speaking to student social workers. And that's the type of holistic frame that queers try to assert, because if, for example, as a teacher, you may have somebody come up to you. A young student comes to you and says he's gay. And as you proceed to talk to him more about how his life is and how he's coping and such, he divulges that he's not practicing safe sex. So all of a sudden you have a health risk as well. And if the parents don't know, or they're not supportive, you're entering social work. Now, how do you think that student is feeling? So low self-esteem, probably doesn't feel good about himself, that's why not engaging in safer sex. So you have psychology. And then you're the teacher. Do you think he's passing his math tests? He's dealing with his identity, you know. So you're reaching into education, you see. So peace education involves a holistic approach to creating change, not as such look at subject by subject by subject, but looking at it all together as a package. Peace education is a dynamic process that pursues to actively promote truth and social justice, breaks down disabling stereotypes, different power dynamics, and differing violent mechanisms, and explores qualities, diversity, and applying deeper and critical meaning to experiential learning. Very relevant to queer, being. This is where we want to head into and such, especially when you have the media, whenever you have a pride event, focus on the drag queens and say, this is what the gay lesbian culture is all about. You know, they don't focus on the gay dads with their children. They don't focus on the familyness that is part of the culture as well. The struggles that are coming out, as well as the celebration of coming out. So that's where we try to raise more highlight toward. Now, Reardon points out 7 R's in peace education. I wouldn't never really limit them to one single letter, so I wanted to change it a bit. In peace education, there's reflection and responsibility, and of course there will be risk in the work that you're doing. However, when she spoke about reconciliation, that's where I felt that, I think from a queer perspective, it's different. if you look right, I see it as also conciliation, the starting of bringing peace between queer communities, queer people, and the heterosexual population. I just think about where I'm living right now, in Kosovo. Albanians were under Serbian control for decades, you know, suffered extreme structural violence, ethnic violence, and such. Sexuality was never on the picture, never on the radar, because it wasn't any chance to, really. And now that the Albanians are in control of their own country, or province, however you see it, they're beginning to look at these issues such as sexuality. And so now we're beginning to see some sort of conciliation, some sort of coming together of people and such. Now, on the other hand, reconciliation is in the queer community as well. I'm just going to try to throw it into a Maltese context. You're growing up, you have the Maltese food, you have your songs, you have your rituals, your traditions and such. You're part of the Maltese culture. You are Maltese, right? And then it comes to a point where you acknowledge that your sexual identity isn't at par with the culture. And somebody, so some pressure that says, no, you can't be who you are here. So after all this investment and appreciation into your identity, into the culture and such, it kind of collapses because there's a sense of you're not a part of now, where you've always felt that you were a part of. And so there we have some reconciliation work that we need to do. We need to bring people back into identifying as being, appreciating of being a gay Maltese person. And that's where we have questions like, are you gay first? Or are you Maltese first? Are you, you know, and those are questions that are big in the debates. Are your ethnicity first or is your sexuality first? Which is it? And so, I mean, this is something that's I ask as being a Canadian with Maltese and British roots, who am I? But that's another session. Recovery, or I see it also as establishing. Reconstruction, or construction. Again, we're starting from something, especially in the Middle East, where the Quran and the Muslim faith completely did not ever acknowledge homosexuality. None of my readings that I've done anyways. Reverence, and I throw in respect. I think that's an important area to have. And activation. I don't see myself as an activist. I see myself as an activator, somebody who starts things. Than I let other people carry on. You know. Peace education includes educational discourses such as human rights education, development education, ecological education, intercultural education, multicultural education. There's a very interesting article that really connects the environment and taking care of the environment to homophobia. In its recommendations is for children to go through some sort of environmental awareness and respect program, and then through that, them having them take care of the plants and the animals around them and take care of the land, they actually develop, they're more likely to develop feelings of human respect and such, regardless of what type of plant you are, in a sense. It was an interesting twist, and I think there's some connection there. Where I live in the Balkans, it's not a very clean place. And I say that in both sense, the environment, plus the way that people treat each other. So I think there may be some connection. I think more research needs to be done into that, but I think definitely the environment and environmental education is part of peace education. It's a necessary component. Multicultural education does not actually include queer perspectives yet. So there's a good master's thesis out there if anyone's interested. That I have never read.
The way it's been used in.
Yeah, it's been used in, yes, and in the States too. It's seen as a racial thing. Yeah, I personally think that if we're looking at culture, now again, it goes against queer theory, but if you look at an actual culture, a queer culture, an existence of a culture, then that wouldn't that be involved in multicultural education? Now, my research, and what I did is I interviewed 6 people from various backgrounds and from 3 different countries, Canada, Iran, and Japan. And then I dwelled on my experiences, my work and volunteer experiences, to come up with some sort of peace perspective that relates to queers. And I came up with 4 different types of, 4 different breakdowns of peace education. This is almost like a stage-by-stage process in some regard. Mind you, things could happen all together at the same time. There are, sorry for the typo, but there are 4 forms. There are 4 forms of peace education in queer contexts. Peacekeeping, peacemaking, peace building, and peace reflecting. Peacekeeping speaks to keeping yourself in a safe and secure manner. So you're not putting yourself at risk for violence or opening yourself up to high-risk situations and such. Then you come with peacemaking, where you have peer groups, support, some cultural events, cultural solidarity, and networking. I'm going to explain a bit more of these as we go along. Peace building, empathy training, which I haven't quite heard a lot of, but it stems from my work in Kosovo, that it seems to be that we need to have some empathy training first in order to move into human rights education. And this is some of the other type, democratic education, some of these other types of educational discourses. We need to learn how to feel for people and their situations and such. And empathy training may be a way of peace building. Policy inclusion, in-service training, and publications. Peace reflecting, reflective learning, social, personal, cultural change, critical analysis, looking back as to what has done, and what would you do differently? What would you change? One participant, she's a transgendered woman who was in the Canadian military. Before she transitioned into a woman, she was living herself, of course, as a man, and she said that, "I was able to fake my way through, not saying much of anything." So peacekeeping strategies are employed to guarantee the personal safety and survival from gay or queer bashings, public humiliation, structural discrimination, and other forms of social cleansing. A type of structural discrimination came up when I was in Japan, where people felt that if they told their doctor that they were gay and that they engage in sexual practices relating to, for example, gay men, they felt that they would tell that doctor would say to their nurse, and the nurse would that this patient's gay, and then that would spill and go into the community. In Kosovo, this is, of course, another issue. This is the same problem. And I see it as a whole, as a form of social cleansing. In Kosovo, when you had the Serbians move in and it was declared as ethnic cleansing when the Serbs were killing the Albanians, and then how we just had it again 2 weeks ago, where NATO declared that ethnic cleansing was taking place, people were going out just to kill people or to move people, destroy their lives somehow, most likely through burning their homes and such, as a form of ethnic cleansing, to get rid of them. Well, social cleansing speaks to the same, except it's not based on your ethnicity. It's based on your sexuality, in a sense. You don't want to have another gay person around, so let's beat them up. Right. And in the queer sense, peacekeeping isn't like what you have now in Kosovo with peacekeepers. You don't have an army to protect you. So what a queer person done has become experts in keeping safe, dodging people, knowing when there's a situation. I was telling Paul earlier, I was speaking on, at the University of Pristina, I was just speaking last week on policy, inclusion issues within policy, and I brought up the gay lesbian question as well as I brought up the disabled question and some of the other minority questions and such. And somebody came up, stepped forward and jokingly called himself gay. And I knew there were gay and lesbian people in the audience because I knew them personally, but they didn't. And because he had stepped forward and made a joke, they stepped back. They didn't make one move to declare. And the whole purpose of the exercise I had them do was to just be proud of who they are. Be proud, and this is a safe space. If you are Catholic, which in Kosovo, that's a minority. If you're a Catholic, step forward and be proud of who you are. You know, and I had thrown the gay lesbian question in, and they didn't. And so I made that a very transformative moment for that guy who stepped forward. You know, and I think he's learned that making jokes such as that of minorities isn't the best thing to do, especially when they're in my presence. So some tactics that were used by queer people to keep some form of peace. Security, safety, was to remain invisible and building other resources available. I remember the young lesbian that I work with in Kosovo, and she said, I'm going to become a psychologist. And I said, well, good for you. Go on. And she says, I don't want to live with my family. So she needs a career. And so she needs to, and that's the way her out, she sees it as. You see, so she doesn't feel, she can tell her family that she's lesbian. She can't share, she has to lie all the time as to what she's doing, where she's going, who she's with, and that jeopardizes her personal development, but she sees that her job success is a way out, so that later she'll work on her openness. And when you sacrifice your personal development, what happens? It leads to destructive behaviors and such. If you don't develop your self-esteem, your self-efficacy, believing yourself as a capable person, then you're more likely to experience some sort of addictions issues, depression, things like that that are rampant through the queer culture that still need to be addressed more so. Changing the behavior so that the person feels less targeted and subsequently less taunted is another tactic that's used. This may include adopting the homosexual is evil discourse to repel suspicions. This is where, if you're a feminine, for example, a feminine gay male, you may very much try to hide that natural part of you so that you're not targeted, so that people won't know that you're gay. Because, as you know, in Western culture, if you're feminine, that means you're gay, which means not a very good thing. Not only does this does the person have to change their behavior so that they feel that they're safe, this, over the long run, creates what's called internalized homophobia, where you believe that all feminine gay men are a certain nature that's not true. You're generalizing. You become homophobic. And this is the same for all of the different queer persons as such. Internalized homophobia is still something that needs to become more explored. Applying other social privileges such as class, ability, race, gender to escape dangerous situations. In my work, my class, my race as being an international, and my gender as being a man in a patriarchal community helps me a lot. In a sense, and there, whenever the gay question comes up, and I'm aware of that, you know. But if it means my personal safety is at jeopardy, I will use that. And this is what has come up time after again: people use the other social privileges that they have in order to feel safe. Escaping to countries that are more tolerant to queer people under the guise of educational and professional development. This is a very common reaction for queer people. Unfortunately, it doesn't exactly help the economy as such in the local, it doesn't help the queer climate of the local culture as well, because what do you have? You have professional queer people because they're focused on their job success. Now, when you have professionals, says, for example, if you're a gay male or a lesbian, head of a corporation, in a culture or a country that's not very accepting to your sexuality, if you have the chance to move to some other country and still have the same success, you're more likely to do that. In my studies, anyways, that's what's came through. And then how that does affect the local economy is a research that is a question that we should ponder more. You know. And this is called the gay drain. You've heard of the brain drain. Call it the gay drain.
Peacemaking.
Now, one of my participants came, like I said earlier, came from Iran, and he was a person that was the top of the diplomatic corps in Iran. He was extremely brilliant. He was the highest marks in history in sense of his diplomatic training and such. Well underway on having a successful career in the high up in the Iranian government. And he was queer, but he left because he knew being queer in Iran is not going to work. And so he left and became a refugee in the States. And this is what he said to me. I realized all queers were white Catholic undergraduate Americans who tend to ignore aliens. He showed up. They wouldn't bother with him. They wouldn't support him. He was looking and looking for support networks, but people would give him the wrong information. They wouldn't include him in the parties and the social events that go on and such, because he's Iranian. And this is where there's a myth that needs to be dispelled, that life is better on the other side. Well, it isn't. I can tell you right now, going to Canada wouldn't be as such easy, you know, if you are a foreigner, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing, yeah. And this is where it gets unfortunate. People are leaving thinking that it's a better life. In some sense, circles, it is a better life, but you have to be on the inside to get the better life. And I felt that when I, and other internationals living in Japan, where I'm white, and therefore I have HIV. That's the connection that the Japanese make and such. And so I wasn't accepted, you know. Peacemaking is where we begin to now heal these wounds that have taken place through efforts such as support groups and such. Things, and this is where we need to get a bit more in tune to in this case, where it speaks to immigrants, to include them in the package. It's a direct challenge to the divide and conquer mechanism that colonialism often asserts onto minorities. We are experiencing a cultural divide. Lesbians against gay men, against bisexuals, against transgendered. Unfortunately, they're not working together. And that's part of the neo-colonialism of heterosexuality and such. And so what peace education do is try to bring these people back together. And one thing that I started doing was having workshops for gay men and bisexual men to come in, because I was funded from Alberta Health, which is another type of structural marginalization, how there was no funding for lesbian health, there's no funding for bisexual women or transgendered, but I have funding for gay men's health. And so I used the funding, brought in, and I always included ability. I always had deaf interpreters because I thought that was important. And And it was through that that we began these workshops that went on for 6 weeks, that we began to understand more of being gay. I think we spoke about HIV for one night, and that was really it. And that's all that's needed, because everything else is important that goes around. That's all HIV programming, the whole 6 weeks, but indirectly and such. Feeling good about your sexuality, talking about your relationships, your experiences and such as being gay. And when you have the gay Asian, the gay blacks, the, you know, the together, I noticed in my work that they began to actually have more of a relationship with each other, the whites and the blacks and the Asians and such. And so those are type of peace building activities, peacemaking activities that could take place.